It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show this week, never mind the PR, can media get better at the HR? Why looking after your talent could help your reputation. Also on the programme, as US newspapers take OpenAI to court, we look at what the Financial Times is doing differently. All that plus we say farewell to the Reader's Digest, discuss the change at LBC, and in the media quiz, we play our most confusing game ever. Oh, God. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, the Telegraph Media Group is officially back up for sale. After months of back and forth between the Competition Commission and the government, Redbird IMI have walked away from the option to acquire the shares, and the bidding war begins again, with owners of GB News, Daily Mail and News UK all looking for a piece of the pie. The Mirror, meanwhile, has a new permanent editor, and it's Caroline Waterston, who has been filling in the role on a temporary basis since January. Waterston will have plenty of work to do, notwithstanding an election and potential change of government. A parent company, Reach, recently announced 700 job losses across its outlets. And Tortoise News' James Harding has expressed his frustration at BBC Sounds this week, telling a Lords committee that ads on UK services would rebound badly for the BBC, and that the app, this is BBC Sounds, should be opened up to more third-party makers. Now, with me here in the London podcast studios, available everywhere except BBC Sounds, we welcome back media writer Maggie Brown. Hello.
Hello.
I haven't seen you since, last week at the Voice of the Viewer and Listener conference. We talked about it a bit in the last show. Did you think it was a good gig?
I thought it was extremely good, especially in the morning. And I think that the quality of both the speakers and the audience really showed. They have a very good way of getting the people you want to listen to into this extraordinary little place. And I think that they do, I'm serious now, they actually do a great job because they believe in the culture, really, of television, of trying to improve people's lives with the broad range of public service broadcasting. I'm sorry this sounds heavy, but that is why I think they're so much respected.
Well, it's also nice to have the voice of the viewer and the listener, and it is a group who are interested in radio and television, some of them with a media background, some without, and actually that's not a bad balance, and also maybe a bit of an older audience that perhaps
it's always older, yes,
don't normally get to hear from.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, remember, they are 40 years old, and so I mean the organization is, so they've actually come a long way from being almost a sort of counter to maybe Mary Whitehouse, in considering the kind of quality television and radio, in particular Radio 4, that they wanted, to become a broader church. I really do think they do a very valuable job.
And down the line, we welcome back Deadline International's investigations editor, Jake Cantor. Hi, Jake.
Hello. Good to be here. I very much enjoyed the VLV conferences as well, I have to say. And one of the best things about the VLV is that audience members often know more about the services than the executives on stage, which always is a brilliant dynamic.
It is. Now, Jake, in our January predictions special, you felt that Alex Mann and Ian Katz would leave Channel 4 this year. How's that looking? Can you perhaps give us a Channel 4 health check on what you're hearing at the moment?
Well, it hasn't happened, so it's wrong. Do I think the chances of it happening this year are more likely as a result of what's happened over the last 3 months or so? probably. You speak to producers and insiders at Channel 4, and there is an overwhelming anxiety about their leadership, and people are agitating for change in a way that I've not really seen before in the 13 years I've covered Channel 4. One producer put it to me this way, that Channel 4 has lost the dressing room, and people feel that it could do with a refresh and a change of leadership and a change of way of looking at things, and yeah, a bit of a creative refresh.
And Maggie, you've been looking at Channel 4 for a little while as well. What's your take on the current top two?
Well, I agree that it's probably time that they do depart, probably when they feel that they've established enough of a change, if you like. I think it runs more deeply, though, because the history of Channel 4 is always that you are not supposed to stay forever. I mean, Jake, you'll know that. That's how it started. The person who stayed longest, Michael Grade, in almost 10 years, had a very bad exit, really. And there haven't been brilliant exits all that well, except I think preceding the current group of people, we had in David Abraham a very stabilising figure who understood how to lead the move into digital and to a different kind of arrangement of programming. And indeed, with Jay Hunt, they did establish some of the big hits that still just about remain with Channel 4. I'm thinking of Gogglebox, for example. So yeah, definitely, I would agree that we're going to see change, but it's hard to know exactly when it is.
Jake?
I mean, I completely agree with Maggie. I mean, if you look at Jay's record, I mean, it's kind of astonishing, really. A lot of Channel 4's biggest shows are from her era. You look at things like Bake Off, and you look at things like Gogglebox and SAS, Who Dares Wins. These are still foundational shows in the Channel 4 schedule. And I think that's probably one of the biggest criticisms of Ian Katz and Alex Mahon, is that they have not ushered in that sort of new generation of ratings winners. They will point to The Piano, which returned at the weekend with 2.1 million viewers and does reasonable business for them. But that's not on the scale of those shows that I've just mentioned. And there is a feeling that they need to work much harder to bring in those kinds of formats that can come back every year and be bankable.
Well, over at the BBC, four female employees have faced an employment tribunal this week as the former BBC News anchors took the corporation to court for redress. I saw you tweeting about this earlier today. This is Thursday when we're recording it. What's the first thing that we've heard from that case?
So it's been a two-day hearing over Wednesday and Thursday this week. As we are speaking, there's just been some developments. The preliminary hearing that took place was to argue what could and could not go forward to the main tribunal, which will be at a date yet to be determined. The four women were arguing to push forward a claim of equal pay disputes, but the tribunal has ruled with the BBC, has sided with the BBC and said that those claims cannot go forward. But the women have succeeded in being able to keep their cases together, which the BBC was trying to prevent. This all looks like, you know, if it carries on this way, this will be a pretty explosive tribunal if it goes to a full hearing and is not settled. And we are going to hear some pretty uncomfortable allegations for the BBC about a recruitment process to hire chief presenters for the news channel, which was finalised in January last year.
Maggie, I mean, these things sort of come back to haunt channels when they're dealing with staff, but also dealing with talent. Is it sort of any surprise that we're still facing these similar responses?
Well, you would have hoped that this was not happening. I don't think this is anything that the BBC probably imagined was going to happen. They have been, I think, almost scared into making cuts because they have, as we know, also they say, lost about a third of their revenue in real terms. It just seemed to me very crass. And when you saw these four very presentable women walking along, and you know that they have done probably very good jobs for the BBC, it's a very hurtful experience, and I would have expected better from them, yes.
Jake, does it point to any wider problems with how the BBC or broadcasters in general deal with talent?
I think this does point to issues at the BBC. I mean, it's kind of staggering that this has been dragging on for more than a year now and we've reached this point. I don't think that someone at the BBC senior enough has seized this issue and said, we need to sort this and we need to sort it quickly. And that's how we've got to this point. These four women feel incredibly aggrieved at their treatment. They believe that the recruitment process was rigged and they were prevented from getting these jobs because the presenting lineup was predetermined before the recruitment process began. They're saying that they were harassed as a result of those decisions, that they have faced other discrimination in terms of their involvement with the union. And they have complained about physical and mental health detriments as a result of these decisions. And the optics of four older women taking the BBC to court over these issues is, I don't think can be understated how poor this is for the BBC. I should imagine that the events of the last couple of days will focus minds at the corporation. And I think it would be in the interest of all parties to settle this and get these really strong professionals back on air.
Well, at the risk of becoming a show about human resources, let's turn to the case of LBC's Sangeeta Maiska, who disappeared off air a couple of weekends ago with no acknowledgement from Global, leaving audiences to speculate over her dismissal. That was until this week, Jake, when LBC announced a new schedule.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is one of the more curious media stories that I've covered in quite a while. I think it's probably a bit of a parable of our times. It shows how quickly conspiracy theories can fester when there's an absence of credible information. The theory that's taken root online is that Sangeeta Maiska was fired for a robust interview with an Israeli government spokesperson. There's a couple of easy public counters to that, if Global is so desperate to censor this interview, then why has it been on LBC's YouTube channel for the past week? And, there are other presenters on LBC being similarly robust with Israel, including, its star man, James O'Brien. I think it's true that Sangeeta's ratings have been in decline, and that has been a motivating factor behind Global's decision, according to people I've spoken to at the company this week. But I also think it's true that they have treated her in a really unnecessarily brutal way and shot themselves in the foot in the process. They have been taken back by the listener response. I think they have found the conspiracy theories that have been going viral online incredibly unhelpful. It's a really sort of unusual story of a presenter heading for the exit door, and I'm not sure that it's been handled brilliantly by Global.
I mean, Maggie, Global can be quite a tough operator.
Yes.
And when I saw this story, my sort of immediate response was they just fancied a change to their schedule for whatever reason, and made it. As Jake says, that's been crashed into by people accusing them of a variety of things. But does this point to the fact that companies maybe need to think more differently when they make changes to schedules for things that in the past they haven't really had to worry about?
I think you're right. And we were previously talking about the Voice of the Listener and Viewer conference. And a very similar thing was actually being aired there as well about local presenters and how attached certainly older people maybe listening during the day as having a companion, how much they were attached and how upset some of them had become when their favourite presenters across the, I think it's 23, or I can't remember how many, had disappeared. And we forget that people do bond with voices and with an approach and maybe a sense of humour that they find both appealing and friendly, actually. The other thing I think about this, the treatment, if I can go back to the four BBC women, is that we had sort of Hugh Edwards also in another universe finally leaving, but having had the comfort of extremely large paychecks while he was, we hope, recovering. So it the juxtaposition to me looks not just, it looks very awkward, and it is upsetting, I'm sure, for a lot of listeners too, who got used to those four women. I must say, I thought they looked terrific as they walked in, and I was watching them, and I thought they looked very well groomed and they looked very determined, and I thought, well, watch out.
Is it quite interesting, isn't it, Jake, with this one? In Sanjita hasn't said anything herself, which has sort of driven a lot of the response as well. And again, my sort of just boring radio thoughts are they've probably paid off her contract till the end of it and given her an okay payout. And as part of that, to just stay shtum on anything connected to it. Because that's the normal playbook, isn't it, on these things?
I think that's very possible. But you had James O'Brien on the radio today. He was asked about Sangeeta by a listener and basically said that her silence had not been very helpful and had allowed all these conspiracies to take root, and she had declined to set the record straight. I think that was the phrase that he used. I'm not convinced that that's an entirely fair thing for him to be saying, for the reasons that you've just articulated. You know, she'll have a contract. I'm sure that contract or whatever the terms of her departure are will say that she can't disparage Global. So why would she risk that money and the potential to be sued by speaking out in favour or to help her old employer?
And also, if silence does make Global look a little bit bad, that's a little bonus positive for her as well, isn't it? By just staying stum.
Perhaps. I can't talk to her motivations, but... I think, it's a bizarre case. I'm not sure it's been particularly brilliantly handled. I think what it does is it speaks to Global's increasing influence in the UK media landscape. I think it's become a really big and important player here in the UK, but it has still quite this sort of small-time family business attitude to running things. And those two things are sometimes in tension with each other, I think.
Well, on other changes to LBC, so Vanessa Feltz is joining the station. She, you might remember that she left Talk Radio last week. We've got the news agents, Lewis Goodall, replacing David Lammy, who not unexpectedly thinks he might be a little bit busy over the next few months.
Yes. I
mean, Maggie, LBC is a growing national broadcaster, and it's had a good few years. Is it becoming a more important broadcaster for the election?
Yes, definitely, because of the audiences it attracts and the fact that it seems to be always there with the, as you say, there's been a sort of reliability of presenters you may or may not get used to. I think also that people are listening on the move. They have a number of ways of accessing radio, which, even though we all have TVs and all the rest of it, it does the kind of argumentative side of radio. I mean, I find myself something, you know, you find yourself almost joining in sometimes and thinking, oh, gosh, you know. And I think that it's a live medium, and it's always reactive. It adds something to your day. And it is a very I agree that it has grown from a very small, you might say, base, but it has become a national force, really. And that makes it really very important. No, I actually like the fact that it's not like the BBC, put it that way.
Also, what's quite interesting, LBC was always the bad boy of broadcasting, and now it seems relatively staid in comparison to sort of GB News or Talk TV.
That is very true. And in fact, that's a very, very good point. They do try to... And I often think when they're having people, you know, calling in, they do, I think, often treat people with a degree of respect. Mm. They do listen to people, and they are prepared to... just stand back a bit and let somebody make a fool of themselves, maybe, but then come back in. And that is a very, they do have very professional, in their own style, presenters. That's what I find. I actually do quite like LBC, to be honest. I'm afraid the thing I don't like very much often now is Radio 4, especially the Today programme. I'm hoping for changes there.
Well, I think when you are exposed to lots of other different types of ways to do radio or whatever media, suddenly you look at the sort of old favourites and think, oh, maybe I didn't like it as much as I did. I just never really saw anything else that's out there. Jake, a Sunday morning politics show for Lewis Goodall. That makes a lot of sense. Him off of the newsagents.
Yeah, I mean, like, the newsagents is clearly a part of Global that's thriving. It's doing really good business for them. I think it's a fantastic quality product, and Lewis is a real star. I think he's, you know, a brilliant broadcaster, incredibly articulate and intelligent and smart, and has clearly been plugged into different parts of the LBC schedule for quite a while now. So to have his own show, I think is a good step for him. I also actually think it's a good step for LBC to be moving away from David Lammy, and for David Lammy to be moving away from LBC. I think that has sort of become, I think it's a decision that suits both parties. It's sort of become a stick to beat LBC with, that it's, you know, giving politicians the chance to present programmes puts it in the same league as GB News. And I'm not sure that the two are quite equivalent, although equivalence is being drawn between them.
And when we come back, more about OpenAI and the media quiz. Don't go anywhere.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Welcome back. Jake and Maggie are here, and we're talking about OpenAI and the US press, because 8 US newspapers, including the New York Daily News and Chicago Tribune, are suing Microsoft and OpenAI. Jake, what's their beef?
So they are basically saying, and the reason I'm going to quote this directly is because I absolutely love this word and I'd not heard it before reading this story today, but they're claiming that ChatGPT and Microsoft's AI system Copilot, they're claiming that it's purloining their content without payment. Now, I assume that means stealing. It's a posh way of saying stealing.
They're saying that their language, like 30s style. He's purloined it off me.
Yeah, he's purloined it. They're saying that the language model near verbatim copies significant portions of their work, and that's what's prompted this lawsuit. It should make out that all of these newspaper publishers are owned by one hedge fund called Alden Global Capital. So there's probably a reason why they're coordinating on this. But, you know, it's a war, I think, that we're going to see more of in the future. We may see some bigger publishers taking similar action, or we may see publishers doing what the FT has done recently, and that's partner with OpenAI, make its content accessible, and presumably generate some revenue from doing that.
I mean, Maggie, the Financial Times approach, is that a more potentially profitable one for news media?
Absolutely. I mean, the Financial Times has fantastic content and it has extremely well-researched articles on a far wider range of subjects, including a lot of foreign affairs, which other papers now really resile from. So when I read the story and I was contrasting it, in fact, with the other way of doing it, I thought it was a very smart move. And remember too, it includes their archives as well, or access to them. Now, we all know, and I mean, I'm always kind of amazed. I spent 40 years or something doing different articles for people, and sometimes mine pop up, in The Guardian, and I link to a contemporary story, and I kind of think, But it has a bearing on the current story that, say, The Guardian is running, or it might be a feature. And so we all know, in whatever sort of media content, it could be films or whatever, there are very often things that are of value long after they've first either been published or they've gone out. And I think with the Financial Times' backlog of things, it must have be sitting on some really very good properties which it can exploit. I think that this is the intelligent way to go, and it was the FT now has, of course, this big Japanese owner. It's got a global spread, and it will be increasingly, I think, backed by them because it has emerged as one of the global newspapers. So when you think about it, it can adapt with new systems. Its content can be translated into other languages. It can go back to stories which are, say, of incredible interest to, say, South Africans, given the state, given the fact that they're just now facing a very important election. Things like that, which will be for segmented audiences too, because of their global reach, but with their own look at things. They're not the same as an American newspaper doing Wall Street type stories. They do global stories. So yeah, I think it's a very good move.
I mean, Jake, isn't it good for sort of all of us really that they're doing licensing deals with good content providers with, as Maggie was saying, they're a great back catalogue, because it improves the algorithm, it improves the material that it generates, improves, I guess, the service more and more of us will be using.
Yeah, of course. They should absolutely be mining the treasure trove of journalism that is on the Financial Times and elsewhere, and not just for the good of users, but because it's like the morally ethical thing to do. They are breaching copyright by using, if they are using, I'm sure they will deny this, but by taking content without permission, they are potentially breaching copyright. And so, it's more than just a case of it being good in the interests of its users. One of the things that stuck out to me about the Financial Times announcement was the chief executive, John Ridding, saying the FT is committed to human journalism. That's not a phrase that any of us yeah. anticipated hearing a few years ago, is it?
No, that was funny. But I think it kind of is, it just shows the way they're not quite the same as, say, the Mirror or the Daily Mail. Yes. That's a sort of very kind of chief executive-y sort of way to put it. Anything that strengthens what we might call even now the newspaper industry or proper
Heritage journalism
is the word I'm looking for, then I'm completely in favour of it.
I think there's something also quite interesting. For some of the things that I do, we use some AI services, particularly around imagery. And the one that I've sort of landed on is Adobe's AI stuff. We're a subscriber to Adobe. And they say that they have all the rights, all the stuff they've licensed to put into it is things they've licensed. And for me as a publisher myself, I think, well, I'm not going to get caught out that something they snaffled a bit dodgily 3 years ago won't suddenly pop up in one of my header images. I mean, that's the other thing, is ChatGPT's got to be able to prove that to its paying customers, that the stuff is not going to catch their customers and get them in trouble.
That's a very good point.
So speaking of publishers that could be in trouble, and definitely are in trouble, the Reader's Digest is no more, at least in the UK anyway. After 86 years, the magazine stopped publishing last week. Maggie, the previous incumbent of this chair, Ollie Mann, was a regular columnist, and he was on ITV's Evening News on Wednesday talking about it. So there's clearly a huge amount of brand recognition from people, but they just, they'd stopped buying it.
Well, I was kind of sad in a way because it was a mainstay of my father always had it, and he liked the fact you could pick it up, and there were relatively short articles in it, and so yeah, it accompanied him, say on a holiday, he would always have it, and no, he subscribed for as long as he was alive, actually, so yes, so I grew up with it, and I don't really think I read it, but it was always there. And one thing that did happen to me was that I actually knew a couple of the people in latter years who were either the running it or one was doing the European side of things. And I had a particular nasty experience, which was a burglary, which one of them commissioned me to write. So I've actually written for them. And they paid me fantastically well. I think it was £1,500.
Maybe this is the problem. Maybe that's what led them down this garden path. I mean, I remember I used to, my grandparents would get it as well. And so I guess as a 10-year-old would enjoy reading the short things, or the little sort of funny bits.
And do you remember they also used to do condensed books? That was another thing. It was a very strange thing. In other words, you would say pick up a Dickens book, and instead of extending to, I don't know, 1,000 pages or something, you would get the core of it. So you had an easy to read condensed book, and they had a whole team that did it. I remember visiting them, and I thought, I wonder how long this is going to go on for.
Well, this is one of the challenges of models kind of drifting. I think at its peak it had about 1.6 million subscribers or sales here in the UK. Jake, it seems again that the staff were the last people to find out that the thing was closing. That's it's a shame there's not going to be any scope for a sort of final commemorative issue.
Yeah, that's massively unfortunate. I mean, Ollie said on LinkedIn that he found out via a LinkedIn post that it was closing, having written his column for a long time. I presume Ollie had nothing to do with the fact that readers were fleeing in their droves. One of the things I loved reading the obituaries for Reader's Digest is this idea that it was sort of one of the first places to give rise to what we now know as sort of internet meme culture. You know, it was a place where there were lots of cat pictures and photos of clouds that looked like celebrities, which obviously is fuels our existence online these days.
It was a forerunner. Well, RAP to the Reader's Digest. Okay, just enough time for the media quiz. This week, it's entitled The Two Ronnies Mastermind Sketch, but as a quiz. I'm going to give you a question, but you have to answer the question before. So buzz in with your names if you know the answer. So Jake, you will say, and Maggie, you will say, let's play the Two Ronnies Mastermind Sketch, but as a quiz. Right, question number one. Who has Universal Music signed a new deal with to allow its artists back on its platform?
Jake.
Correct. Question number two. Which TV series, originally Project Kangaroo, launched this week?
Jake.
Yes.
TikTok.
Yes, that's right. And question number three. Which award-winning British comedy starts its final series this week?
I do know the answer to this, but I wanted to... So it's Jake.
Jake.
Oh, no. It's Freely, isn't it? Is that the answer?
Freely TV, correct.
Yes.
And our question number four, who is the real baby reindeer?
Maggie.
Yes, Maggie.
Inside number nine.
Yes, correct. And that's time's up. And I think that makes Jake our winner for a thing we will never do again, producer Matt. I think you did a good job there. Pick up with some of those. Jake, what do you make of the baby reindeer controversy?
Oh, it's kind of extraordinary, isn't it? This show landed with like kind of no marketing, with no fanfare whatsoever, and has absolutely exploded on Netflix. I mean, it is doing absolute gangbusters, not just here in the UK, but internationally and in America. Listening to The Rest Is Entertainment with Richard Osman and Marina Hyde earlier this week, they made some really good points about compliance and whether Netflix did enough to make sure that the identities of the characters portrayed in this drama were protected enough. And given that The Stalker, the series is about a comedian who is stalked by a woman, and it's based on a true story, and the identity of the stalker character has been outed by internet sleuths, and she's, you know, done an interview with the Daily Mail in which she's talked about being victimized and being taken advantage of. So it's all a bit messy.
I mean, there's something that's the quite interesting thing in the piece about the nature of stalking, and they've sort of inadvertently created a witch hunt that is very much like stalking. I mean, it's a sort of a very modern problem, but Maggie, as Jake was saying, this is something that Netflix probably could have guessed would happen, you would have thought.
Well, I mean, are Netflix upset about this huge interest that they've generated? It seems to me, I when I was reading about it, it seemed to me like a sort of whodunit, you know, trying to sort of, I think they've deliberately almost made it a question hanging in there. Now, hasn't Nigel Farage... I don't know. He's entered the
He's entered the chat.
Everybody enters all of the, never one to miss a good opportunity.
Yeah, it is a strange one. And I mean, the Richard Gadd had to basically do a social post last week saying that someone else wasn't the person for the thing that happened in episode 4. I mean, it's all got a bit complicated, hasn't it, Jake?
It has. I mean, look, I think the starting point is it's a stunning and quite remarkable bit of television, I think. An incredibly raw story told brilliantly. But I really, as I say, I do think there are questions for Netflix and the way they've handled this. I think if it was on the BBC, there wouldn't be this kind of internet guessing game, because the BBC would have done a much better job of protecting the identities and providing probably a better duty of care to all of those involved.
And also we touched on Freely there. Freely is the sort of sequel to Freeview and Freesat, run by Everyone TV. It's IP version of kind of watching live telly. Do you think it's got a good chance for success, Maggie?
Well, why not? I think it's an addition, isn't it? And it's broadband based,
yes,
isn't it? No, I mean, we all know that they did Freeview pretty well, actually. So it's just a development on that. And it shows that they're still in the game, really. Mm. They have it's the four public service broadcasters coming together as before. Plus, I think the two language services as well.
Yes.
So, yeah, why not?
And Jake, I was reading a bit about it this week. They've talked a lot about Freely being available in sort of TVs. You can go and get a TV with...
Smart TV.
Yes, with Freely in. But it's not sort of available as an app yet. You've got to buy one of those TVs. Are they a bit behind the game, or do you think this is the right time for a PSB IPTV service?
If they are behind the game, then they're not necessarily entirely to blame, given that something quite similar in Project Kangaroo was blocked by the government, you know, more than a decade ago, before streaming was really a thing. I think it makes complete sense for these organisations to come together and do something like this. They probably are a little behind the curve, but this probably is a fairly inexpensive way of bringing themselves together and trying to increase their scale.
And it gets around this issue that some people really don't want to take out subscriptions.
Yes.
So it's designed really for the ordinary viewer who wants to have that kind of service. And so I don't think something that's offered freely, literally for free, given if you've got to have the right TV, is going to flop. It's going to be taken up. It probably won't change the world. But if for example, it had happened in 2007. But it's definitely an addition, and good on the public service broadcasters, I say.
Well, congratulations, Jake, for winning the quiz. A high sense, Freely TV is definitely in the post to you right now, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Thanks to Maggie Brown and Jake Cantor. Jake, where can people keep track of what you're up to?
I am on X at Jake_Cantor, and check out deadline.com.
And Maggie?
Well, actually, I'm going to be in America for the next month, so probably...
You can't catch up with her. You're having a lovely time.
I'm going to be having... Well, yes, I am going to have a lovely time, but yes, I am on X as well.
Well, send us a postcard. Thank you both.
Bye-bye.
That's it for today. Remember, there's 25% off your first booking at the London Podcast Studios, where we record our show every week when you use the code MEDIAPOD. Just head to thelondonpodcaststudios.com for 25% off when you use the code MEDIAPOD. And if you're new to the show, remember to hit follow so you get every episode in your podcast app of choice. My name is Matt Deegan. The producer was Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production. And I'll see you next week.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Monday, it's the anniversary of the table knife being invented.
On Tuesday, we explain how the tradition of the two-minute silence originated in Cape Town.
On Wednesday, we recall the day King George III proved he was assassin-proof.
On Thursday, let's all eat cake. It's Marie Antoinette's wedding.
And on Friday, we discover how Buffalo Bill helped invent the Wild West.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.